Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're going to love today's show, and you'll want to listen to the whole thing because you're going to hear from a very successful CEO who basically conquered his inner voice and became a very aware, very successful person along the way. So the whole story of how he got there and the science and the tips and tricks and tools that he used are scattered throughout the episode. So listen to the whole thing and enjoy.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks may actually have some truth to it, because they just looked at a new study of 54 human brains, and they said maybe adult brains are not capable of forming new memories. The study showed that adults stop making neurons in the hippocampus, which is known as the memory center of the brain. And in the samples they tested, in young brains, there were lots of new neurons. But as people age, the numbers decline, even starting at age 13. The good news, though, is that this isn't the last word on that study, since it's just about impossible to study the brains of living people this way. The researchers behind the study, they want to understand other explanations for the results, since other studies show neurogenesis varies amongst people and animals. Now, my take on this is that it would make sense if you don't have the right levels of a compound called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. If you can't build new neurons because you don't have the juice your brain needs to do it, then you're going to have that problem. You can raise BDNF through almost every technique that increases mitochondrial function that are in my book, Headstrong, including cold exposure, high-intensity interval training, intermittent fasting, and exercise. Exercise raises BDNF meaningfully, and there's a supplement called Neuromaster, yeah, it's one that I make, that raises BDNF 4 times more than exercise. I just turned 45. My hippocampal volume is in the 88th percentile for my age group, which makes me think maybe I'm doing something right by supporting my BDNF levels. Maybe you should too. In the meantime, I'm going to sort of say, you know, I am an old dog, sort of, and you can teach me new tricks. And if you don't really think that's possible, then you should play me in ping pong because I'll kick your ass. All right, there we go. I just learned to play ping pong. I'm kind of good. Not that good. On that note, let's talk about today's guest. Today's guest is Eric Langshire. Eric is a best-selling author. In fact, his book I'm holding up right now, and it's called Start Here. And the reason I want to have him on the show today is that he talks a lot on mastering your own well-being. Eric had a very successful career in corporate America, left the rat race, and started an investment company to focus on improving the human condition. He started something called Care Pages, which is one of the very first social networks way back in the day. And his book called Start Here, Master the Lifelong Habit of Wellness is something that I really enjoyed. I got to speak with Eric on stage at something called YPO, a Young President's Organization event a while back. Got to know each other. And this guy's really studied how to be happy, both as a corporate executive and just as a human being. And I think he's got something to offer for you guys. So Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about what you did as a corporate executive. How successful were you? Why should we listen to you?
Well, maybe the place to drop in is to begin with a confession and let you and your listeners know that my career was mostly an accident. I took the first job that was offered to me out of undergrad, worked for a company called Pratt & Whitney, the jet engine manufacturer, and ended up spending 13 years with them and their parent company, United Technologies, then went to work for another Canadian company, Bombardier Aerospace. You know, I had a great ride of it and loved the industry and loved what I was doing, but then had the calling.
Come on. You didn't just work for them. You're president of a large aerospace company.
You know, Yeah, at a young age, it was just a great ride. And again, you know, all kind of accidental. I was just putting one foot in front of the other. But the change for me really came in 2000 when I got the bug to become an entrepreneur and walked away from the corporate America world to start my first company, CarePages, which really came out of a personal experience associated with the birth of my first son, Matthew, who's about to turn 20. And Matthew was born with a congenital heart defect and had to have a series of open heart surgeries in the first few years of his life. And it was one of those incredibly stressful moments in our lives, but also wonderful in so many ways. You know, obviously being a first-time parent is a remarkable thing. But then, you know, to go from hoping that Matthew is being born with, you know, with all the gifts to be smart and athletic and good looking and have all the social skills to quickly transitioning to, boy, you know, we just want this kid to live and to know what it is to be happy and lead a good life, turned out to be a blessing and really set the course of our lives on a very different trajectory.
So you're president of a big aerospace company, and then you had a child with some serious health conditions. Did you just quit one day? Like, how did you go about doing that?
So Matthew was born in 1998. And at the time of his first surgery, when he was a week old, we created an HTML web page, a care page, really a social network to keep family and friends informed of how Matthew was doing and how we were doing. And it's hard to even think back. I mean, it's not even 20 years ago now, but the internet was really in its infancy. And, you know, we weren't, you know, Facebook didn't exist. MySpace was not around. And we used this tool, this care page, to keep family and friends informed of how we were doing and how Matthew was doing. And it turned out to be just a tremendous, tremendous support mechanism and really a communication aid in our world. And so by the time Matthew had his third surgery, we were receiving thousands of hits a day on the site. And there was a message board where people could leave notes of support. Had a huge, huge impact on our emotional well-being and the emotional support that our family and friends and colleagues were able to bring to us. And my wife, who's a pediatrician, and I was in the airplane business, we thought, let's make this service available to patients and families everywhere. And we quit our jobs. We said, what's the worst thing that can happen? It wouldn't work. We'll go back and get another job. And then here we are now, 17 years later, and still working in technology and entrepreneurship and loving it.
It's funny because when CarePages first came out, one of my good friends had at the time, the youngest surviving preemie born. And I actually used CarePages right around the time that you guys launched it, because that was how he stayed in touch with family and friends when his child was in, you know, the ICU almost all the time. So it really was one of the first social networks and a really impactful thing that helped a lot of people at their time of need. I don't think a lot of people understood that was started by, you know, president of big aerospace company. And since then, you've been on this path where you say, look, corporate America is getting sicker and sicker, and you've studied this well-being thing through the lens of both being a substantially accomplished executive as well as being the father of a child with meaningful health problems, and sort of looking at what's the impact on humans for that, and then put it into a book about it. So let's start with why corporate America is so sick, and then let's get into your recommendations for what to do about it. So
sure.
What's going on? Why is America so screwed up? Well, not America, but why is America and even European, it doesn't really matter, but why is the corporate world so sick?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is externally focused. The other is really internally focused. If we look at what's just going on externally, you know, the pace of play just continues to accelerate. Technology, which has improved our lives in so many ways, is also making us sicker. Kleiner Perkins did a study a couple of years ago to measure how many times we check our cell phones every day. It's 150 times. It's absolutely remarkable.
That's it. I could do better.
Exactly. Right. But the pace of play is accelerating. And 75% of Americans now report that, you know, they're stressed. Since 1999, the percentage of Americans that are on antidepressants has increased from, you know, just under 17% to over 13%. You know, we have somewhere between 50 and 70 million Americans who are, you know, suffering from sleep disorders. 4% of Americans take, you know, sleeping pills to sleep at night. We are just increasingly, you know, and just increasingly living at the effect of, you know, these external forces on our lives. And the thing about it, though, and this, we write about this and start here, it's really an inside game. And this was also very much linked to my own experience. Somewhere around my 40th birthday, I remember waking up one morning and realizing, as I was, you know, making my way to brush my teeth, that I was living at the effect of a hyperactive mind and was very, very anxious. And it never occurred to me that the that feeling of stomachache feeling that I lived with pretty much every day of my life was truly anxiety. And I decided I wanted to do something about it. So this is really what got me on the path of researching what can we do about it, and how do we bring a level of sanity and calmness to our own existence, starting with my own.
How did you learn that that feeling in your stomach was anxiety? Like I went through the same experience. I'd love to share my story with you as well. But for people listening, maybe you have some anxiety that you don't know is anxiety, but just tell me the story of that.
Yeah. Well, I began to read. So I said, my whole thing is I'm always looking for the most efficient way to go from A to B. And so in this case, what I was looking for, the most efficient way to start to feel better, to start to feel happier and more calm and more peaceful. So I began to read and started picking up self-help books and started reading philosophy. I had the view that there's a lot that I could learn from people who have come before, including the greatest thinkers throughout the ages, from the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, the modern American transcendentalists and modern European existentialists, and just began to study the great philosophical thought of the ages. And two things happened. So the first thing that happened was I realized that in fact this ever-present stomachache was in fact anxiety, and it started to grow. As I became aware of it and started to put a label on it as anxiety, I became acutely sensitive to the fact that I was really massively stressed. So that was thing one. And then thing two is, when we do anything frequently enough, I began to see the patterns in all of this ancient wisdom and all of the knowledge that has come before about a life well lived, and started to apply some of the thinkings and decode the patterns and start to experiment with different practices in my own life. And that set me out on this path of start here and life cross training.
So there wasn't like a religious wake up call one day, like, oh my God, that's anxiety in my stomach. It was a dawning awareness as you studied personal development and the wisdom of the masters, basically.
Right. Okay. With, by the way, because of the growing, the growing feeling of anxiety as I started to label it, they're just, my body was screaming, stop doing what you're doing, because this doesn't feel, just doesn't feel good.
I went through this time where at the dawn of the internet as we know it, there were only 10 web pages. I was the first guy to sell anything over the internet. And there was a time when I knew everything on the internet. And as it started to grow exponentially, I started sleeping less and less because I'm like, there's so much good stuff here. I'm just going to absorb it all. And I look back, I'm like, wow, I'm barely sleeping and I'm completely wigging out if my email goes down, which was a standard thing in the early days of the internet. Like, you can't check messages for a day because someone misconfigured something. And I would just feel like I was going to die. And after a couple, maybe a year of this during the first hyper growth of the internet, I'm like, I am completely wigged out by this, like, information overload and like a fear of not knowing something that I could know that was interesting that I wanted to know. But I didn't label it as anxiety. I'm just like, I'm going to have to accept defeat or failure. I'm going to fail to know everything on the internet because it's growing faster than my ability to absorb it. And that was one wake-up call. But then the real one for me, I still would have said, well, it's not fear. I'm just like, I wanted to know, and it's more like I'm failing. I don't like to fail. I went to this personal development retreat, and there was all sorts of crazy stuff going on. And there was one exercise people were doing, and full disclosure, they were hitting pillows with bats. It was a very high-tech personal development retreat. Anyway, some people were really getting into this, and I'm like, these people are completely nuts, but I couldn't stand to be in the room with them when they were doing that. And it was like, I have to go. And so the facilitator, who is this incredibly wise woman who's about 80, she said, no, you have to come and sit in here. I'm like, I can't do it. And keep in mind, okay, I'm a successful entrepreneur. I'm like, I don't know, 30 years old or something like that. I'm master of my own universe in my own head anyway, and I can't sit in a room with a bunch of people hitting pillows with bats. And she said, well, why can't you sit here? I said, I don't know. Like, there's a feeling. And she goes, what is it? I go, I'm pissed off. And she goes, that's not the feeling. And what triggered me to tell you this, Eric, is you said the feeling in your stomach. And she said, well, do you feel anything in your body? And I said, yeah. I feel this weird feeling in my gut. And she looks at me like right in the face and she goes, that's called fear. And I'm like,
yeah.
I go, really? Like, there's a name for that? And that actually unlocked a lot for me. I'm like, oh, so I am feeling fear. But I had told myself there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing to be anxious about. Therefore, I'm not feeling anxiety. And since then, I've met thousands of people who have anxiety but don't label it as anxiety, so they don't know it's hackable. And so your path is interesting because you just one day sort of after studying for a while going, well, I know I'm not happy. What is it? You came to the point, all right, I'm anxious about something. What were you anxious about?
Everything. And my pattern was I'd wake up in the morning and my eyes would open, my brain would turn on, and then just the torrent of thoughts, uncontrolled thoughts would just start. Just, you know, what do I got to do in the day? What's going on with the kids about this thing that the conversation that I had the day before, the conversation I need to have later that day, is the litany of to-dos. And it all just would just pile on, and I had no control. And the irony is, you know, I had learned how to manage large businesses, and I had learned how to, you know, manage, you know, thousands of people, but I didn't really know how to manage my own mind. And that was an incredible awakening.
Thanks for being vulnerable enough to say that. When someone looks at, you know, the president of a big company, you're like, that's a guy who has his shit together. And what I think we're finding out is that no matter what degree of success you have in whatever you do, whether, you know, you're an executive or an artist or a teacher, it doesn't really matter, a parent, you can still have anxiety and still be phenomenally successful. And that's not something that they teach, but it's something that you discovered, right?
Right. Well, a lot of us use it to make us productive. We just forget the fact, it does work. We forget two facts, right? One is it makes us sick, and two is there are just better ways. And that's actually what I discovered is, you know, thing one, that well-being is a skill that can be trained. And the way to do it is to train the skill of attention, really get control of the mind. And then all of that can be done in a way that's deeply integrated into the living of our lives.
What are you like today? Like describe your anxiety process or what goes on in your brain now versus 20 years ago.
Yeah, I was just completely different. My experience of being alive is completely different. And I share this with people. You know, we've trained now thousands and thousands of people in this, you know, in this methodology. And just, you know, part of that is that our experience of being alive can just be fantastic. Imagine living with spaciousness. Imagine living with peace. And then I know, David, you know, you're a practitioner of these arts and, you know, in the biggest of ways, right? But it, and then to be around that is just attractive for people. And the irony too, in the business world, because I, you know, run a significant investment entity, I'm so much more successful than I ever was because I just bring a different energy to it. And I work really hard, but it doesn't feel like work. A lot of energy, and I'm thinking myself as being in the energy management business.
It's that last statement that I hope listeners really resonate with. It's that when you work on the stuff that you worked on, this lifelong habit of well-being, it's easier. Like all the work that you're doing out of like fear of failure, which was a big motivator for me, all the energy that goes into that fear goes into the business instead, so that it's much easier to do the things that you wanted to do. And that perspective is a reason also that, like when we first met, I'm like, oh, let's have dinner. Like we're both sharing a stage, but it was one of those things. Oh, this guy's not tweaking all the time. And there are a lot of people who are successful who are really not that happy and not that comfortable to be around. Right. And right. It's that feeling that you carry with you, even though, you know, you're in now running a big investment company, it's hard to put words on it. And I'm hoping that people listening get a little sense of that just because of the scope of your success and your willingness to talk about the inner process that happens, where a lot of executives just don't go there because part of being a corporate executive is, you know, that invincible kind of chest thumping, you know, I can manage this, you know, I'll hop on my jet. Of course, the jet you manufactured in this case, you know, fly across the world and, you know, do my thing and, you know, run an Ironman marathon and all that, but that's not actually what's going on in your head anymore. But what happens? Okay, you have a big investment and it just completely goes sideways. You know, you're going to lose a bunch of money and, you know, someone's yelling at you. What goes on in your head?
Well, it's a big question. And it happens.
Totally. I mean,
it happens every day. Stuff goes sideways every day. You know, it's not always an investment, but it's a conversation. It's a deal. It's this, it's that. It's all part of the juice of life, right? And understanding that, and this is one of the practices that we write about in the book, of which there are nine, but this idea of inquiry, of questioning, you know, questioning our fundamental beliefs. Is it true? So is this good? Is it bad? And bringing a degree of equanimity to it. So it's just so much more interesting. And I think productive in the business world, say, okay, something's gone wrong. What can we learn from this? And what can we do to, you know, rat over, you know, something's gone wrong. Who do we blame? Who are we going to fire? You know, it's just a whole different energetic. It's a different perspective. And what it does is it helps foster and create an environment where people can, you know, can truly, you know, out problems really early, where there's not a, you know, cover your butt kind of orientation to, you know, coming to work and. I mean, it's just remarkable what the spirit of all of this stuff can amount to in sort of the corporate world.
So it happens, and then instead of going, oh, I'm going to die, or, you know, oh, this is terrible, and sort of telling yourself a story that makes it more painful, like, what can I learn? But is there still that, like, the chest tightness, the teeth gnashing, the I'm not going to sleep well tonight, or does that just not happen to you anymore?
No, not over here. That doesn't. I don't experience that. Yeah. But it took time. And you know, part of the journey for me, especially in the early days, and again, this is what led us to writing the book, is when I started to explore these ideas, I was overwhelmed by the volume of things to pay attention to, and, you know, call it the noise. There's, you know, there's the internal stuff, there's the external stuff, the diet and nutrition. And I had always been mostly focused on the external. So I had, you know, intense exercise program and run a marathon every year and controlled my diet and certainly was one of the early, you know, bulletproof, you know, seekers and explorers and you know, was open to great experimentation and with a view to, you know, how does it feel and what is my experience of this? Is that being the ultimate sort of proof point for me? But when I started to enter into this other domain of looking inside, you know, this is one of the early quotes I remember reading from Jung, which just absolutely resonated. You know, he who looks outside dreams, he who looks inside awakens. I mean, I really did awaken. And what I discovered was I needed to find the signal through all of the noise of all of the different ideas that are out there. So that's what Start Here really does, is we distill this ancient wisdom into a set of practices and programs. Then we went to the neuroscience community and the positive psychologists and said, what about these ancient ideas really work? Let's get into the science behind it and let's prove that this is an efficient path from going from A to B, and let's see if we can measure it, because that's again a big for me an important on ramp is into the science of it, but also to know that there's some empirical data here to support, you know, some evidence to support these these are big ideas, and that's what we did in the book with my co-author Nate Klemp. It was really remarkable to distill these ideas into practices and ideas that we can actually integrate into the living of our lives in a really efficient way that moves the needle on well-being. So, you know, to your question, you know, how do I feel today? It's measurably different.
Now, I'm happy you said measurable, because how do we measure well-being?
Well, it turns out we actually can measure well-being. There's lots of different ways. We worked with University of Chicago scientists, and we developed an instrument that lets us measure productivity, emotional health, resilience to stress, focus, you know, 13 different measures that roll up into aggregate measures that actually give us a score, you know, on what we're sort of, where is our set point, you know, set point of happiness, and we can track changes in that set point, you know, over time. And it's really pretty cool.
How long does it take to do the assessment?
10 minutes.
Is this something you do every day?
No, I do it every quarter.
Every quarter. Okay.
And we don't recommend that people do it every day. It's a wonderful empirical piece of evidence to underscore, you know, what you're feeling, but check in with how you feel. And that's really one of the, one of the really big drivers for us here. What we're able to use it for in the business world, because we've formed a company around this, like cross-training, is we're really able to use it to demonstrate to employers that it's absolutely worth investing in your people, because this very simple equation of, you know, so goes human performance, so goes business performance. And where we dropped into this conversation, our people are impaired. And it's really quite remarkable. And we can measure an improvement in people performance and then correlate that to improvement in business performance. And that's super cool.
I've been lecturing to entrepreneurs over the last year or so. And one of the big messages is that, especially for younger companies, the company is a direct reflection of your energy. Like if you're off, your company will be off. And when companies hit the scale of, we'll call it small, mid-sized companies like Bulletproof and countless other companies out there, it becomes not just a measure of the founder or CEO's or executive team's energy, although those are heavily weighted, it's everyone's energy in the company. So if half your employees are unhappy for whatever reason, whether it's because of their home life or their corporate life or whatever else, because they're drinking diet soda all the time, it'll affect company performance and certainly well-being of people there. They didn't teach you that at Wharton. They haven't taught that
right.
Kind of anywhere, because it's very hard for us to measure the state of our well-being. And so your idea there that says, well, here's a repeatable quantitative metric that you can use yourself if you're running a company or if you're just running a family, it doesn't really matter. I find huge value in that. And it's something I have not rolled out with the team at Bulletproof, although we use a bunch of other metrics. Like everyone has their love language visible. So
right.
If you're going to acknowledge someone, stuff like that matters. But like, if one employee wants a pat on the back, literally, and another one doesn't want you anywhere near them, but they like a gift. Hey, if you know that, then, get them a pencil that says thanks. Like, it's easy, but only if you have the data. So I'm intrigued. I'm not promising that I'm going to do this, but I'll chat with my team about potentially rolling this tool out to do at least a beta. Because it'd be kind of fun.
Well, and it matters. And the data at a national level is just incredible. That this year we'll lose $370 billion in productivity due to just people not being engaged at work, something that's preventable, right? We lose, our healthcare spend. What is the cost of stress-related disease, in this country? It's almost immeasurable because it's so significant. Think about the cost of turnover, unwanted turnover, and the cost to replace, someone that you've just lost for whatever reason. It's big bucks.
It completely changes everything, and just the disruption, and it slows things down.
Right.
So then now we've got a tool that people, I didn't ask in terms of getting access to the tool. Is there an online version of it? I know that you write about it in the book, but just in terms of a listener saying, I want to know how I'm doing right now. Is this accessible, or do you have to be a company to do it? I haven't taken the whole tool.
You can write us at info@life-xt.com and we'll send you a link.
Okay, that's cool. So, and by the way, obviously we didn't plan that, so there's no affiliate or anything like that. I'm just like, oh, this is kind of cool.
But I want to come back to something that you said, which is just, I'll put an exclamation mark about it. I mean, think of the energy that you bring to your work and your company. And then having everybody that works, across the growing Bulletproof empire, right, bring that same energy, and the things that you can build in, the tools and the rituals and the support that you can build into just the course of a day that make, just make it not just a great place to work, but that invest in people's well-being, which then helps them invest in their wellness. Because we know the science of habit change. And so we can teach the science around well-being, and then they just start to make better life choices. And everybody wins, and just everyone's easier to be around.
You write about a bunch of tools for training that skill of well-being in your book, but you also talk about the secondary thing, which is training the skill of attention. What's the difference between training attention and training well-being?
Well, we think that attention is the key here. So we've developed what we call the master practice of notice, shift, rewire that does two things. It really leverages the science of habit change around training the skill of attention, and I'll unpack that in just a second. And it really it leverages the what the scientists know to be true about the fact that our brains are neuroplastic. So our brains literally change. So if we can use our brain to develop attention to change our brain, this sort of starts the upward spiral of goodness around this. So notice, shift, rewire is just a very simple practice that helps people do it. So notice, just notice that we're lost in thought. And Matthew Killingsworth's, you know, seminal piece of research that came out of Harvard a few years ago, Killingsworth and Gilbert, you know, determined that our minds are wandering 47% of the time, so half the time. And most importantly, when our minds are wandering, we're less happy. So if we can start to notice, you know, that our minds are wandering and then shift, which is this idea of just bringing our attention back to what is here now and in the present moment, and then rewire by just spending, you know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 20 seconds with, you know, with the thought, with the new thought to which we're choosing to attend to, you know, then we stand a chance of being able to control our minds. We're learning how to control our minds, and we can start to unpack all sorts of amazing practices, gratitude, relationships, contribution, compassion, on and on and on, that, you know, that lead to, you know, incredible well-being, and then downstream, great wellness.
It reminds me of that cliche story about, you know, the Native American who tells his son, you know, there's wolves, you know,
yeah, right.
which one are you going to feed, the wolf or the whatever? I'm forgetting the full story,
yeah.
But you know, which one wins, the one you feed, and you feed,
that's right.
You feed those things love. With your attention. Right?
And it's the whole game. William James, psychologist, my experience is what I agree to attend to. You know, we choose where we place our thoughts.
As long as you're aware that you're placing them somewhere, and that's that skill of attention that you write about in your book.
Exactly right.
Do you have advice for people listening who might want to learn how to integrate training, or just how to train the skill of attention into their life? Like, how do you do this?
Sure. And that's what the book is. It's just full of tips to help people do that. So first is, let's just unpack a little bit about the science of habit change. And, you know, we've distilled the science into just three easy to remember things to do. So the three C's, we call them. So commence small. If we want to start a new habit, which is, for example, training the skill of attention, this is work that comes out of BJ Fogg and Stanford, Tiny Habits. Just start small. And this is where my co-author, Nate Klemp, and I completely blew it. We said, okay, we're going to notice if we wire all day, every day, which is impossible. We were bound to fail with such a, you know, sort of impossible to achieve goal. But with a tiny habit, you stand a chance. So BJ Fogg gives the example of, I'm going to do one push-up. Right? Everybody can do one push-up. Right? Chances are, if you're doing one, you'll do more than one. For us, we decided to set cues, which is the second C. And this is the work of Charles Duhigg, right? Just set up a cue so you can remember to do it. And then thing three is commit. So commence small, set a cue, and then commit. And commit is to make 100% commitment. So not a 99% commitment, which, as they say, is a bitch, but 100% commitment, which is really a breeze, because it removes the possibility of even negotiating in your head. So a great example is, I'm going to make a, I'm, you know, January 1st, I'm going to go to the gym every single day at 6 a.m. Now, that's not a tiny habit. That's a big one. And then what happens is, we wake up and we begin the conversation in our head, and we start negotiating with ourselves. Well, I'll go after work. Well, I'll go tomorrow. I'll just skip today. And then the parade of horribles really starts. But if we start really small, and we determine a cue, and then we set, we make 100% commitment, it really just makes building in any habit that we want really easy. So we begin with that. And then, you know, as we lay out in the book, we have three foundational habits in what we call the train section. And these are meditation, movement, and inquiry. And these are things that, you know, Dave, you write about and talk about all the time. I mean, the power of, you know, training the mind through meditation, it's a foundational habit. We recommend that people do it for 5 minutes a day, you know, 3 minutes if you need to start a habit really, really tiny, but you can build. And there's lots of fantastic, you know, tools and support aids out there. Movement, you know, you're the Pied Piper here of, you know, diet and exercise, and how to, you know, build in biohacks in a way that are just incredibly efficient. But then inquiry, which is a form of meditation of questioning our stressful thoughts, you know, asking, is it true? And again, that is learning to notice, shift, rewire, learning, you know, what are we thinking about, and identifying those stressful thoughts. And then we have six more practices in the book that sort of fall into the, what we call the balancing of of being and doing, which is, you know, being a human being and being, engaged in the world, being present and showing gratitude and compassion, and then doing, you know, focusing on relationships, focusing on engagement, really productivity, and then contributing to the world. And you can take any one of these habits, build, you think about the science of habit change that we talked about, break it down, and then build it into where we literally don't have to stop and, and go and sit on a cushion for an hour a day, or go, you know, live in a cave and meditate for 3 weeks. So a good example is building the habit of presence. It's learning the science of what it is to engage the parasympathetic nervous system with a 4x4 breath. And then using a stop sign when you're driving, just to notice, I'm going to come to a full stop, I'm going to take a 4x4 breath as I'm pulling away. Very straightforward.
Very simple habits that just continuously throughout the day reset the nervous system.
Exactly right.
I ended up going down the path of using lots of feedback for that. Things like heart rate variability training and learning, oh, this is what it feels like when my body is kicking out of that calm, attentive state into something else, because it's not a signal that I learned to pay attention to. I don't think most of us do. And
right.
Going, oh, now that I know that, I know how to go back. But until I learned to sense it and then to do something about it, like it was all noise. I'm like, oh, wait, there's a signal in the noise. And then that became just a habit. So anytime you feel yourself becoming oversympathetic, maybe anytime, most of the time anyway, you catch it and then you can do something about
right.
it. But only if the attention is there in the first place, which is why I think it's kind of cool the way you talk about attention and then building that in.
Right. No, exactly right. And then once it's built in, you don't even have to pay attention because it's just there. It's subconscious and it's serving you.
Yeah, it becomes a habit, right?
Becomes a habit, right? Which is incredibly efficient.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, partly because you've had this incredible career and you see a lot of meditation teachers who have focused their life on meditation and do spend 2.5 hours a day meditating, which is an incredible luxury in order to be able to do that. I've found I have 2 kids and more than one job as CEO and a husband and writing books and all that stuff. I don't really have 2.5 hours a day to meditate. It'd be kind of cool, but if I did, I wouldn't. I still have other things I'd rather do. I'd at least hook electrodes up to myself while I did it
right.
and accelerate it. Like there has to right. be a way. And so you found a way without spending 2.5 hours a day meditating. How many hours a day do you meditate?
Well, I have a profound meditation practice. So I spend about an hour a day
okay.
in a formal practice on the cushion.
You do.
That okay. said, I'm meditating all day long. And all so right. this idea, and I love where you're going with this, because the idea of integrating these habits in our lives is really where I started. Because I didn't start with an hour a day meditation practice. I started with 5 minutes. But I also started with when I have a really intense Starbucks habit. So I'm at Starbucks a few times a day. And when I'm in line at Starbucks, I'm keeping my phone in my pocket and I'm just using it as an opportunity to practice the skill of presence. Completely integrated, easy to do. And now when I walk into a Starbucks, I actually just habitually go into a complete kind of mode of presence, because it's just my way of being now. Similarly with the practice of gratitude, I needed a cue, in the spirit of Duhigg, I needed a cue to remember to practice gratitude. So I built in 2 cues. One is when I wake up, I won't get out of bed without just literally taking 1 minute to engage the mind and all the things. And there's just so many of them to feel grateful for. And the other is meals. And as I sit down, with our family and I've got 3 kids as well, and they tease me mercilessly that I say, "Hey guys, let's do gratitudes." And it's gotten to the point where I don't even say that anymore. I just do it, and they just look at me, and it's great fun. But in order to develop that habit, I had to put a sticker by my place at our dinner table at home, just to remember to notice, shift, rewire. So, notice, here's an opportunity, shift to gratitude, and then rewire and just stay with it for 20 seconds and let it sink in. It's the neural feedback. And so we can build these habits into the living of our lives in incredibly efficient ways.
Very cool. All right, an hour a day. What kind of meditation are you doing for an hour a day?
Well, it varies, and it depends really on what's happening. But this morning, for example, just pure Dzogchen, you know, eyes open, everything open, just sort of an open awareness practice of watching what is here now and what is, and just a fantastic practice.
Now, your kids are what ages?
19, 18, and 15.
That's why you get an hour in the morning without.
Yeah, oh, it's different. And I get up at 4.
Okay.
So that's another secret.
I am not a morning person. It's not my chronotype. I woke up at 5 a.m. every morning for 2 years, and I meditated for 1 to 2 hours a morning. And it was beneficial. I found you could replace, you know, 2 hours of sleep with an hour of good meditation. But once I had kids, they have spidey senses and they know when you wake up. So they'll wake up too.
No, I've heard you say that. The first time I heard you say that, I just laughed because it was exactly it. I've always gotten up early, and our eldest son would always be up early with me. I'm thinking, well, what's that about? Right. Of course, it's exactly that.
It's like I was going to meditate, but now, you know, let's not. And so that definitely changed my practice. I do more in the evenings, and I frankly do more with computers stuck to my head because that's very focused time, and I get a higher return on that investment.
Right.
But I'm abnormal that way. Just that
well, I'm really excited to do 40 years of Zen, so that's in my future.
Whenever you're ready, it'll be there for you. Now, I think we've talked a lot about meditation and just the idea that you're a phenomenally successful guy who's built this into your life, not by going off to some monastery somewhere and having a jump in with both feet, but in an incremental path of just growing awareness, studying, making small changes in habits, and then ultimately quantifying it so you can see that it worked, which is kind of the core recipe for hacking anything, which is figure out that you want to work on it, figure out a measure, do stuff until the measure changes, and then you know the stuff works. But then the next step of science is, okay, why did it work? Like what are the underlying mechanisms? Can you walk our listeners through some of the mechanisms of like why the body will change when you grow awareness, when you grow attention?
Well, the big idea here I touched on a few minutes ago is that of neuroplasticity,
right?
That the brain is neuroplastic. We know this now. We didn't know this 50 years ago, but now we know it. And Donald Hebb, who's really the father of this research, you know, first coined the expression neurons that fire together, wire together. And we know that. And that's the underlying science that drives, this the habit formation and all of the work here. Now, as we, double click on any one of these practices, and, you were talking about memories and the hippocampus, and, you double click around the brain and we think, what happens with compassion? So Helen Wang and Richie Davidson's lab in Wisconsin, who's really, the preeminent neuroscientist who's done work on, the brain and meditation, did a seminal piece of work on compassion meditation and found that just, a 30-minute dose over 2 weeks, 30-minute dose a day for 2 weeks, literally, changes the brain, shrinks the amygdala, drives much more activation in the left prefrontal cortex, increases feelings of altruism, on and on and on. I mean, it's really interesting. So the different practices ignite different, different regions of the brain and different mechanisms. And I'm speaking to a great expert here. It's exciting stuff. It's an exciting time because that the other piece that is especially encouraging is the volume of research now that is being done and funded and being released on all of this is incredible. And we're going to look back at today and we say, God, we were living in the Stone Ages. what were we doing?
Right? I think so. And it's also necessary because we've got a lot of people on the planet. And if you have a lot of people walking around full of anxiety and fear, they generally don't take care of the place. So when we have a little bit more attention and awareness, we might like the world we live in
right.
more than we do now.
Yeah. No, that's right. And this is the Dalai Lama's big thing. Just, compassion is really the only thing that we need. And it starts here. It starts at home.
Yeah. If you don't have compassion for yourself, it's hard to have it for something else.
Right.
Right.
And how much better is it to be around that energy?
It's a lot more pleasant, a lot more fun. And my experience has been that the more I can cultivate that stuff in myself, the more I like it. But also then I end up meeting just really cool people and I have the opportunity to make friends, that I might not have made friends with before. And it's definitely enriched my life. But it does require, having that arm wrestling inside your head for a while.
Right.
Now, I definitely enjoyed Start Here, and I thank you for sharing all of your knowledge and wisdom on the show. And I have one more question for you. If someone came to you tomorrow, Eric, and they said, look, I want to perform better at everything I do as a human being, what are the three most important pieces of advice you'd have for me? What would you offer them?
Well, I'll answer that question this way, and I'll key in on the word advice as opposed to three specific practices. And I'll drop in with just this, again, the core idea that well-being is a skill that can be trained. It is about training the skill of attention, and we can do it in a really efficient, integrated way in living of our lives. So thing one is build a foundation. And what that means is develop some form of meditation practice, whether it's, formal on the cushion or, a presencing practice or the Socratic practice of inquiry, but it's just foundational for looking inward. And it could be 5 minutes a day is a clinically effective dose, but it's a good place to start. Thing two, and we talked about it, is develop attention through the skill of notice, shift, rewire, which is, I know you just had Sean on the podcast. It's kind of like Insanity or P90X and CrossFit for your brain. That's what Notice Shift Rewire is. It's just an internal workout that lets you cross train anywhere, anytime, carry it around in your pocket. No one knows. And you're just constantly changing your brain and literally leveraging the biology of neuroplasticity to your advantage. And then thing three is I'd say, engage, read, listen to podcasts, find, so plug into the community. There is so much content now being produced, and it's fantastic. I mean, just literally the Bulletproof podcast alone. I mean, the range and the variety of topics that you cover is really, it's very cool. But it's also inspirational, and I think for people to not lose the thread of encouragement, of inspiration, to know that there's people out there who can help and can encourage you. I think it's important.
Well, thanks for the plug, I love that advice, which is learn from others who've done the work.
Learn from others.
It's okay to be lazy that way,
right? And keep learning, though. That's the thing. Keep learning. There's this notion of effort and courage and all of this, and it becomes habit, right? It becomes easier and easier and easier. But you can choose to spend 20 minutes zoning out on Facebook or sitting on the couch, flip on the TV, or sort of engage in a practice that is actually going to lead to, different conditions down the road and fundamentally make you happier.
Very well put. If I'm keeping track, that's two.
One is build the foundation, two, engage in training the skill of attention with notice shift rewire as a master practice, and three is learn from others.
Oh, learn from others. Okay, cool. Got it. That was a good summary. Thank you. I merged the first two together. I'm like, you got one more for me, man. But all right, that was three.
Right.
Eric, people can find your book online. It's called Start Here. And where else can they go to learn more about the ability to measure their stuff? You gave an email address earlier. Let's repeat that again.
Sure. It's www.life-xt.com. It stands for Life Cross Training. And of course, you can buy the book through the site, which will link you to any bookseller, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you name it.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for being on Bulletproof Radio. Thanks for being willing to talk about what goes on between the ears and even further down in the heart and gut and everywhere else in a successful CEO and investor and just generally good human beings. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Great fun for me.
If you like today's episode, you know what to do. Head on over to iTunes. You can go to bulletproof.com/iTunes. It'll take you directly to the show page and just leave a quick review that says, hey, this was worth your time. And if you read Start Here head on over to Amazon, and authors like Eric and me, we look at those reviews, and so does everyone else. When you do that, it does two things for you. Number one, it lets you express gratitude, which raises your IQ by at least 100 points right there. Okay, maybe not, but at least you got to express some gratitude. But more importantly, you get a lot of value from spending. I'm guessing it took me about 2.5 hours to go through the book. So if you spend 2.5 hours and you get way more return on that time than you put into it, leave a review, because that matters actually way more than you actually buying the book, just going there and telling us how we did as authors. So take the time to leave a review for Eric and for anyone else whose book is really cool. It's a simple thing you can do. It's like way easier than leaving a tip at dinner, but it really matters for us. So thanks for doing it.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.